You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
All right, well, John Buckman from Magnitune, welcome to the G'day World Show.
Thank you.
Now, John, I've been doing a little bit of research. I guess I first discovered Magnitune about 6 months ago when I bought a CD of one of your artists off the site, and consequently did an interview with the artist, and he was sort of talking to me about Magnitune and about emerging business models in the music business. And so I've been watching you from afar over the last 6 months, but you've actually been around for a couple of years, haven't you?
2.5 years now.
And so from what I've read about your background, you were running an email software company and your partner was signed to another record label. You weren't happy with the deal that she got at the end of the day, even though I believe the record label she was with was one of the good guys. But you saw some big issues with the music industry and decided to take the bull by the horns and set up your own internet era, 21st century, web 2.0 record label.
That's basically right.
So tell us a little bit about the premise behind Magnitune.
Well, you know, the first was to speak what you just talked about, which is my wife getting a record contract with another label. That label tried to do it the traditional way, which is to say making CDs and getting it distributed and sold in stores. And what we saw is even though they had very good intentions, the industry is just so filled with, I call it just evil, which is to say just everyone is out there to destroy everybody else. And ethics and corruption are words you kind of get used to. And I thought if you're going to try and actually sell records or sell music in this day and age, you need to avoid making CDs and selling through stores because they'll just be destroyed. So what if I or somebody made an internet-era record label? Someone who said, let's not make CDs, and where else can we focus our attention? So with Magnitune, the goal was to take some of the music that I love and find a business model under which it can flourish.
And how did you actually get started? How did you start signing artists?
I mean, that was hard. It took about 6 months to develop the site, just from the technology and getting all the legal agreements together and such. But I'm a big fan of a site called CD Baby, where independent musicians send their physical CDs and then they're sold. It's essentially a CD sales store. And I went through there and listened to hundreds of artists because I knew they owned their own rights if they were on CD Baby.
Yep.
And from that, convinced 20 musicians that they should give me a try, even though the site wasn't even up yet. The intention being, if I found 20 very good people, then that would give birth to more artists. The trick was finding a 20 that would cast a lot with someone who was just starting, which isn't easy.
Now, I read in, I think, the biography that you've got up on your website that about 6 months after you started, you read Courtney Love's open letter to the RIAA, which I recall fondly. I mean, I think a lot of us were kind of amazed that Courtney Love could actually write, let alone write such an amazing piece of work that I think inspired a lot of people. And what's your take on the future of the music business? Do you actually think the big labels are going to survive the next 10 years? Are they going to get themselves out of the situation they've painted themselves into over the last decade?
Well, I think they're clearly going to survive. Half of their profits come from the back catalog, the Led Zeppelins of their catalog, and people aren't going to stop loving that. And some significant portion is going to keep buying that in some form, whether it's iTunes or CDs. So they're not going to go away, but I think much like how the internet has changed the software business, that essentially most software companies need to be internet-focused, and the companies that weren't really lagged behind and had significant opportunities for people who focused on the internet, we're going to see record labels who embrace the internet and who embrace a less evil ethos. They'll do quite well, and they'll take some market share away. But when all the names that we know and love are locked up in essentially perpetual contracts, it's going to take quite a long time, 20 or 30 years, for new companies to get us familiar and to love new kind of music.
But let me drill down on that with you, though. You've obviously got a slate of artists. How many artists do you have on Magnitude at the moment?
I have a little over 200 artists.
Okay, so you've got a stable of 200 artists that you're working with. And, you know, I think one of the things that, for all the evils of reality TV, one of the things that they have made completely evident through shows like American Idol and Australian Idol and all the pop stars variants around the world, is that there's an amazing wealth of talented singers and songwriters and musicians around the world, most of whom, you know, I know from my own experience in the music business over the last 20 years, most of whom are going to spend the rest of their lives working a day job and playing music for the love of it in their home studio or on the weekends doing the occasional bar mitzvah or on the pub scene. And I guess the thing that fascinates me is this idea that over the course of the next decade, with the fact that everyone's going to have a mini recording studio either in their home or in their friend's home or garage, the ability to record music, distribute that music globally over the net. Is there? Do the economics of the music business, as they have been for the last century, hold up when you have all of a sudden the barriers to entry for all of these talented artists out there just basically get swept away? When there's, instead of tens of thousands of new CDs coming out every year onto the market, there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of artists making their music available to the world. Do the economics of the business, are they able to hold up under that kind of Cambrian explosion of new talent entering the market?
I think the economics are pretty bad. Just to step back, I mean, first of all, unique in the music industry, you've got an industry that's loathed, that's just hated by its own customers. People steal through LimeWire and other peer-to-peer services, half to get the music, the other half, frankly, because they think they're striking back at a fairly corrupt, evil industry that they don't want to support. Even those that don't use peer-to-peer services often don't buy CDs because it's buying from a cartel that is not constructive to the world. So first of all, you've got that problem. And what that does is it causes people to actively seek out ways to accumulate music, buying or pirating, in ways that don't contribute to the music industry. The top four labels, when I call the music industry, is really just four companies that control 90% of what's sold. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is there was a very interesting article called The Long Tail that came out about 6 months ago in Wired magazine that showed that the mass market is largely a product of limited distribution. For example, Amazon makes only one-third of its money from its top 40,000 titles. So what that shows is Amazon makes two-thirds of their money from incredibly obscure things. And that wasn't just Amazon. It was record stores and video shops and such, that basically people's tastes are much more diverse. People are much more interesting than really the just top 40. The top 40 may, in fact, only account for a quarter of their sales, or a third is what it looks like right now. So I think that the mass market, which is shipping CDs or boxes of plastic all over the planet into local shops where people hopefully buy them, is not a great business. First of all, that's the first step to get pirated. It's a youth market, and they're very internet savvy. The real money really is in all what I call the secondary genres, and that's everything from classical and world to, frankly, punk and metal and all sorts of electronica genres. Those are the things where most of the volume in music is sold, but it's diverse. You've got tons and tons of releases selling maybe 5,000 copies each. Not anything the labels want to do, and a great opportunity for independent artists. The one thing that's going to really keep artists from really benefiting from the Cambrian explosion, as you say, is the internet is just a gigantic, huge place. And it's very hard to get found, even if you have a website and you have great music. And so sites like Magnitude that listen and filter and aggregate the very best of independent music, I think will do very well.
Well, I agree with you. If I look at the economics of the music business, to me it always seems the cost side of the equation seem to fall into three basic pillars. You have the cost of production, the cost of distribution, and the cost of marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems in the last, 5 to 10 years in particular, the cost of production has dropped exponentially with computing.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of distribution now is, approaching zero thanks to the internet and broadband. The cost of marketing and how do you get discovered, with all of the noise that's happening out there is still the big challenge. And I think that you're right that sites like Magnitude, I also think that podcasting is a fabulous new way for people to discover new music. With my company, TPN, we have 3 or 4 music shows at the moment where the hosts filter the best emerging bands that they can find that are sort of unsigned or not with a major label and put them out as a weekly show.
Mm-hmm.
So I get 3 hours of music podcasts available to me each week where I get to sample, 10, 15, 20 high-quality emerging artists from around the world. So I think there's a number of emerging models that are coming out. But, even if these artists aren't actually able to... I mean, they're not going to be making Britney Spears money out of their music business, but the very fact that they're producing high-quality stuff and making it available... I have to question whether or not I'm actually going to walk into a CD store ever again and fork over $30 for a piece of plastic.
Especially when you know, first of all, that it's going to go to, fairly nasty people, mostly lawyers and all sorts of middlemen, and maybe the musician, once it sells 500,000 records, will start making something. One of the points of the Courtney Love article was that... if you sold 500,000 records, at the end of the day, you would see about $50,000, which is kind of a middling income U.S. Salary. So it really, I think a lot of musicians will look at that number and say, well, I'd much rather sell, for example, 5,000 albums at $10 each and make the same amount. Plus, it's all theirs and they're in control. And certainly if they sell twice as much, then it's twice as much money. So I think you're right. And actually, podcasts are really funny. Right here in the States, we have the New York State prosecutor going after Sony. In fact, Sony just admitted to what's called payola, which is to say paying radio stations in various illegal ways to play music on the radio stations. What's funny is it's illegal to play Sony music on podcasts. So you have this strange situation where Sony pays radio station to play music, then get sued by the government doing it. At the same time, they refuse to let podcasts, which are nothing but radio stations on the internet, just time-shifted, to use their music. So it's a great opportunity where just the general stupidity of these monolithic companies opens up a great opportunity.
Well, it does, and I get interviewed all the time by journalists about our podcasting company, and one of the questions that always comes up, particularly if I'm being interviewed on a commercial radio station, is, well, how are you going to get around the licensing issues with playing APRA music? And my response is, well, they can keep their music because I'm really more interested in using podcasting as a channel to help emerging artists discover an audience. I don't give a stuff about, the RIAA artists. They can keep it.
It's actually very interesting. You have the same mind I do, which is I'm not interested in putting Warner out of business. I just think Warner is irrelevant. So I'm not
absolutely
fighting Warner. I just don't want their music.
Yeah.
And if they can find some business model on their own, more power to them. I just don't think that any of my audience or anybody I know is very interested in the Britneys that they spew out.
And now on TPN, it's time for a break.
Mixtape.thepodcastnetwork.com is the mixtape.
Yeah, what it do? You already know who this is. It's your boy Dex Digital with the mixtape. Mixtape.thepodcastnetwork.com. The only hip-hop podcast y'all even need to be bothering with. And that's the truth. Anyway, check out the main site. We got weekly downloadable shows and it's free, y'all. So if you're broke, don't worry, I got you. Anyway, freely downloadable shows, as I said, every week. It's either a music show or an interview show or just kind of a combination of the two, because I can make the shots, so tough you, listen to my show. Also, check out the site. Just on a daily basis, we've got random examples of just irresponsible hip-hop journalism. It's The Mixtape, mixtape.thepodcastnetwork.com. Get at me.
You know, I'm not interested in music that is produced by lawyers and accountants. I'd much rather listen to music produced by real artists who are trying to create something that's new and different and has a level of integrity about it. You know.
Of course.
Let me ask you some other questions that I'd love to get your insights in. I mean, I was thinking about this over breakfast this morning. If I go buy a mobile phone and I fork over my cash for the mobile phone, and then I decide I want to give it to a friend of mine to use, I can give him my mobile phone and he can go use it, and Sony aren't going to, you know, take me to court for giving away my music. Well, my friend's not going to get taken to court by Sony for stealing the phone, because I've paid good money for it. When I pay good money for it, it becomes my property and I can do with it as I wish. Now, obviously, that's not the same for what we think of as digital intellectual property. If I go and buy a CD and then I decide I want to share that CD with a friend of mine, not only can I get charged, but my friend can get charged. Do you think that those sort of intellectual property laws need to be revised?
No, I think they're great because they incredibly anger consumers who will have nothing to do with companies that sell that sort of thing, thus hastening their demise and replace it by companies that aren't so stupid.
So when somebody buys, an album or a track from a Magnitude artist, what are the intellectual property rights that go along with that?
Well, they own it just like they own a CD, and they can pass to somebody else. I mean, legally, if they pass to somebody else, they're supposed to stop playing it. But it's the same thing with a CD. You could certainly make a CD dupe and then sell it. Nothing is going to keep you from doing that. No one's likely to sue you on that. But you actually buy music on Magnitude, and then you own it. And in fact, when you buy it, you get a WAV file, which is an exact copy of the CD. It's not lower quality. You know, the same thing that the master CD was. So yeah, it has resale rights, but also you've got a clear title to the music. Whereas when you buy music that has digital rights management, it's not even clear what you own. In the old days, when you bought software, you would get a CD with a serial number, and it was clear that there were two keys you needed that you could pass on. One was the installation CD, and the other was the serial number, and whoever owned that owned the software. With music, they've gotten rid of the serial number. You know, I think they could get around some of these nasty things if they said, well, if you buy something on iTunes, here's this 10-digit proof of purchase. And if you give that proof of purchase to somebody else, then they own the music. But I don't think they want to do that. And a pretty big reason for that is the record companies hate the used marketplace. Something like a third of CD sales are actually used CDs. And so they could increase their sales by just making it illegal to resell music. You know, that's a handy thing for them to do.
Yeah. Let me ask you another question that's kind of related to that. It has been in my mind for a few years when I think about my favorite artists, the artists who I am most passionate about, and I've, you know, been passionate about for many years of my life. You know, when I think about what I'd be willing to give money for with that artist, it's less about the intellectual, it's less about the music, and it's more about wanting to have a relationship. Obviously, a virtual relationship with that artist. So, for example, some of the ideas I've been pushing to friends of mine in the music business is things like, if let's pick an example. Let's say Lou Reed came to me and said, "You know what? You give me $50 a year. Give me your credit card number, and I'll take $50 a year. And here's what you're going to get for the $50. You're going to get every piece of new music that I put out, and I guarantee you at least one new track a month." Mm-hmm. So I get my 12 tracks a year. Mm-hmm. Plus, when I tour, you'll get priority access to tickets. Mm-hmm. Plus, you'll get you know, invitations to web chats three times a year, plus you'll get, I don't know, invitations to backstage parties or whatever it is. You know, it's I would easily give up my credit card for that kind of a relationship. I can, you know, easily with at least a dozen of my top artists, because the music is just one aspect of kind of the I don't know, the experience of the artist that I think we look for when we really get inspired by somebody's writing or by their music. And it's almost like the music is just part of the deal. You're actually paying for the experience. Have you seen or anyone starting to develop alternative models along those lines, or am I crazy?
No, I don't think you're crazy at all. I mean, there's a couple things. One is music is culture, and culture deeply resonates with us and has meaning. It has the power to make us cry. And so it's not bubblegum. It's really important to us. I mean, one example is on Magnatune, when you buy an album, you can name your price, and half goes to the artist. So the prices are in various currencies, but in dollars, it's from $5 to $18. And if you choose to pay more, you don't get anything more, except that the artist gets half. So if you pay more, you're supporting the artist more. What's interesting is, though the minimum price is $5, on average, people pay $20. So that's indicating that they want to pay more because they want to support this artist, and then they feel good about it. Now, back to your question of a bigger package, Prince, if you join his club, will in fact offer you, I believe they reserve the front two rows at each concert for people who are members of the club, their exclusive singles, and I believe some of the live shows are also available. So it's clearly a much tighter connection. I just came back from a conference in Washington, D.C., and saw a website, artistshare.com, where jazz guitarists put up draft versions of their songs along with sheet music and various live takes, and so you can buy that and participate more deeply. But I think what it is when something touches you, you want that, you want to support it, and you want to be part of your life. And it's not about making someone filthy rich. It's about just acknowledging them and giving them enough money so they can survive.
And so they can keep producing it, right? You want them to do it again.
That's right. I mean, in U.S. dollar terms, my goal has always been to get them $50,000 a year, which is just a nice, healthy living. You can have a kid and send them to college, but you can't buy a Ferrari on that. And 99% of the musicians I meet, that's really their goal. It's just they want to be able to do music, and if they can just have an okay financial position doing it, then that's what they want to do.
Well, if you took any other industry in the world and you applied the economics of the music industry to it, and you said, look, I don't know what it is, but let's say 1% of the people working in your industry are going to make mega bling-bling, and maybe another 1% or 2% will eke out a living out of it as session musicians.
And then 10% will commit suicide each year from exploitation.
Exactly. And then the rest will work in IT or wait tables and just, you know, do bar mitzvahs on the weekend. If you applied that to any other industry in the world, maybe outside of acting, any other, you know, if you applied that rationale to the IT industry, which I come out of, for example, everyone would think you're totally fucking crazy. No one would buy that. Everyone would say this is completely dysfunctional.
Right.
And I agree with you that, you know, the goal of a musician should be to earn a reasonable living. If you work in a 40 to 60 hour week, you should, you know, make a decent, I would say, a six figure pay packet. But six figures in Australia is about $50,000 in the US. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, well, a question that gets asked all the time, right? So the slogan at Magnatune is, we are not evil, and there's evil both to the consumer and to the musician in this industry. And they ask me, how could you possibly survive on 50%? You know, you only get half the money. So only the music industry can you say 50% is not enough. I mean, you go to a supermarket, and they're making out 12%. You talk to Dell Computers, and they're under 10% in their margin. In most any business, a 30% profit margin is extraordinarily high. Yet 50% is seen as low. So only in the music industry is it normal to have a 90% profit margin on these CDs that are sold. And you know, the consumer is rebelling against something they know is absurd, which is, if I make 1,000 CDs, they cost me 60 cents each, and I sell them for 18, that's abusive, exploitative pricing. And then the other thing that's happening is the musicians are starting to realize, slowly, that their chances of making a living and doing this as a career are much greater if they don't go to a major label. Because the typical scenario, and Courtney Love has outlined it, and there have been other articles on the internet also, that usually at the end of your 3 or 4 albums on a major label, you actually come out several million dollars in debt to the label. But they have the option of calling if they really want to be nasty. But essentially everything that they can think of as an expense gets charged to the artist so that they have a very high profit margin. So the only way, really, the only people who survive the major industry machine are those who can sign a 7-year, 7-album deal, and at the end of 7 years, still be a name and take that marketing and now actually get their albums sold. But the first 7 years, you just have to throw away, as that just goes to the label to try and build your career. The other thing people don't notice until they go into a label is only about a third of the records signed by a major label are actually ever released and promoted. The vast majority sit what's called in the can, just sit there waiting until the right market opportunity, or sometimes they just sign them to make sure that nobody else will get them.
So you're familiar with Kazaa, I'm sure, and there was here in Australia last week, I think it was, the court gave their ruling on Kazaa to basically shut it down. With the all of the court actions that the music industry has been taking against the peer-to-peer, both from a consumer perspective and also the application or service providers like Kazaa, do you think that this is really just a strategy for buying time? I kind of suspect that the only reason that they're suing companies like Kazaa is because if they don't look like they're doing something, their shareholders would realize the jig is up and desert them immediately rather than desert them over the course of the next 5 years.
Yeah, this is a cornered cat is what you're looking at, you know, scratching at everything. Even the friendly firemen trying to kick them off the tree, they're still scratching at everyone. And actually, this conference is very interesting because there was someone from the Electronic Frontier Foundation opposite the CEO and president of the RIAA. And the RIAA said, you know, we all have to be a family and we all have to get together, and all this hyperbole is really destructive. And we want to work with the peer-to-peer services and have them pay license fees and on and on. And then the FF interrupted and said, look, this is a complete fabrication, because actually Napster offered $1 billion over a 4-year period. So $1 billion is what they were willing to pay in licensing. And the RIAA turned them down because they really wanted to destroy them. And the net result is that you have companies like Kazaa, who were created specifically in the knowledge that what they were doing was illegal and using national jurisdictions to make them hard to shut down. And you just have one after another. So the courts judge what Kazaa did as illegal or are in the process of. So new companies have popped up that, you know, fit the latest definition of how to be legal. And it looks like the future will probably be actually not companies, but things like BitTorrent, say not companies, but open source free projects where there's no one to sue because no one's making a profit, so you can't shut it down. The other comment the FF made is in July, the month after the Grokster decision, Big Champagne, which is the company that tracks peer-to-peer usage, reported that that was the biggest file trading month ever in the history of file trading. So the Grokster decision didn't seem to have any effect. In fact, usually the summer is a quiet period. So they're basically afraid, and they don't know what to do, and they're mostly acting out in fear. There are positive signs. For example, 2 weeks ago, Warner announced that they would start an electronic-only label, an online-only label, where musicians would keep the right to the music, and there'd be a slightly higher percentage paid. So I call that a less evil label. The details are fairly scant right now, and I assume it's really for the top artists. but they're aware they need to change.
Mm. And what's your take on something like iTunes? iTunes good or evil?
A mix. I mean, on the one hand, it's great that iTunes has shown that there's both demand and also that consumers would buy online music if the storefront, if the interface weren't so awful. I mean, you look at things like buy.com and you just can't imagine what the software designers are thinking. And then iTunes is a fairly good interface. So clearly there's that. It's really good. It's not great, and it's not the iTunes' fault. It's just the milieu they operate in, that they have to pay the record labels money as opposed to paying artists directly. So the reality is iTunes mostly serves to prop up the old regime. The irony, of course, is the old regime is too stupid to notice that iTunes is doing them a great favor, and they're actively trying to destroy iTunes. I don't know if you've heard, but two of the labels have threatened not to renew their contracts, so that would take two-fifths of the major label content off, unless iTunes significantly raises their prices on individual tracks.
Hmm.
So, the myth was actually a founding principle behind Magnatune was, look at iTunes and all the other online stores, they're very, very controlled and constrained in the kinds of things they can do, and that's because they're beholden to four companies that control 90% of the music sales.
Yeah.
So every single business model they conceive of has to be vetted by some fairly regressive people. The only way to really try new ideas out, there's like two ways. One is to get your own content, like we do with Magnatune, and then we can try things out. And the other is to work directly with independent labels who are interested in trying things out.
Yeah. And I know that I've read some articles over the course of the last 6 months. Every time, you know, the music industry comes out and says, oh, CDs are falling, CD sales are falling, and it's all because of these nasty pirates. I've read a number of studies saying that the fall in CD sales actually has more to do with the increase in sales of music DVDs and that consumers...
Well, first of all, that number is completely fictional.
Oh, really? Tell us.
Yeah, it's a completely fictional number. There are two numbers used to calculate CD sales in the U.S., at least. So there's the RIA number, and then there's the SoundScan number. With the RIA tracks is units shipped to stores. And what SoundScan does is SoundScan is a service that works with stores and installs software at their teller, at the till, so that every CD sold is actually accounted for. You can imagine the SoundScan number as being incredibly accurate, but it's not the number the RIA uses. They use numbers of CDs shipped. And lo and behold, the numbers of CDs shipped has actually gone down for the last several years. But there was a 2% gain in the States in the SoundScan numbers last year. What this is largely attributed to, frankly, is the large record chains being much better at what's called just-in-time shipping, which is to say they don't hold inventory. They get CDs just as they're shipped rather than holding things locally. So that's one fact that's quite interesting. Also, the shipping numbers were and continue to be widely manipulated through promotions. A record label that wants to chart a CD need only get an arrangement with a record chain to ship massive numbers of CDs to their warehouse. That then helps them chart, which then helps them get radio play and then eventually sales. That's, you know, been an old system that's existed. If the CDs don't sell, they just get returned to the record label later. So the record store doesn't take a lot of liability doing that. But it's all a friendly system.
And I assume the artist actually doesn't see any money until there's actually a retail sale. They don't get paid on shipping to record stores.
Well, I mean, there are many, many clever ways to not pay your artist. The simplest is this concept of what's called recoup or recuperating all the expenses. What that means is when you sign a deal with a record label, you as the artist will only make money when all the expenses are paid. That, on the face of it, sounds very rational. What's difficult is what's an expense. And through some fairly sloppy accounting, it's possible to charge almost anything against an artist. So, for example, if you hire a PR firm to promote 100 artists, who's to tell what each artist's PR fee should be? Well, I can tell you, it's very easy. It's whichever artist is making money is who you should charge all your expenses against. So when there's a CD sale at a store, that will go into some artist's balance, showing a slight positive movement. But as soon as it starts to go above zero, say it's not a negative number, they'll find some expenses to charge against and then bring that number down. That's largely true until the CD sales are so high, usually above 500,000, that they just can't manufacture expenses anymore. But there are many other tricks. So, for example, artists aren't paid on promotional CDs. Again, in the contract, that seems very reasonable. What you don't realize is it's quite typical for a label and a store to have an arrangement where for every CD that the store buys, there'll be one promotional copy. In theory, that's to give out through contests and other promotions, but the reality is the store just sells them. And so what that does is half the actual effective royalty collected per CD.
So it's not as simple as the press releases from the RIAA.
The only people who make money off the system are the Elton Johns, who have immense clout and who the labels know will be able to manufacture hits in the future. And then they're on equal footing, and they make good, very, very good money. Anybody else, it's just not going to happen. If I get the exact numbers right, but it was something, there's major labels recoup, which is to say, actually pay back their own expenses in something like 80% of the CDs or the releases they make, whereas the artist recoups only about a third of the cases, which is to say, actually makes some sort of positive money back. One of the problems is actually a number of the artists are frankly quite greedy under the system, because what happens is if you don't trust your record label ever to pay you again after this CD is made, then you're going to fight tooth and nail to get the absolute biggest advance you can. And then, of course, if the label has to beat an advance, then they're going to make sure the contract is thoroughly evil to make sure they never pay you to get the advance back. So you have this atmosphere of distrust between artists and labels, such that even well-meaning labels now have trouble getting reasonable agreements from some artists. It's something I butt into all the time with Magnatune. It's why on the website it says we're a record label, but we're not evil. Because a lot of artists, when you say we're a record label, they immediately think, oh, well, you're one of the evil people.
Well, look, John, I know you've got to go, but I really appreciate you coming on and giving us the background on Magnatune and on the industry. Before you go, though, just clarify for me what the rules are for podcasts who want to use Magnatune music.
So let's say non-Magnatune music, say if you are on a podcast music out there, you need to have an agreement directly with the artist giving you permission to do so, or an independent artist that said it's okay. All the Magnatune music, if you go to the homepage, you'll see podcaster music as a link on the homepage. As long as you give us attribution, which is to say, we just played this song by this artist available on Magnatune, then you can play our music for free without permission needed on any podcast. And we love to do so, and I give interviews all the time on podcasts because I see this as a major way to avoid the whole pale radio world and let them all die while podcasts and independent record labels flourish.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time, John. Congratulations on the success of Magnatune, and I wish you all the best for the future.
Thanks so much.
And the only proper way to go out in the show where we've had John Buckman from Magnatune on is to play a track from one of the Magnatune artists. And the track I have chosen is a very funky little jazz track by a Magnatune artist called Drop Trio. They're a groove-oriented, organ-based funk jazz trio from Houston, Texas, home of James Kendrick and Sherry Kendrick, and they've had a not-as-wet weekend as they expected to have with Hurricane Rita, which is good news. Anyway, this is a track that's available on the Magnatune website, and it's called Wreck of the Zephyr.
Podcast Network. Real power can't be given. It must be taken.